Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Just the idea of existence is so terrifying. And then so many scary things can happen. And sadly, there is, as we know, you know, I don't know if we want to use like capital E evil, but, you know, humans can do evil things that there's something I think in horror that, like, by acknowledging that is actually very nurturing. It's almost like it gives us a platform to test out our fears and test out kind of, you know, our reactions to it, that to me feels like almost maternal in a way, like almost like it's allowing us the space to go there. So we're like prepared in life.
I'm Jordan Kistner, and you're listening to Thresholds, a series of free-ranging conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they made afterward. My mental associations with the poet Dorothea Lasky are all joyful. She has this big, incredible laugh, which used to echo out of classrooms in the halls at Columbia, where she co-directs the poetry concentration, and I used to be a student. She's quick to smile, and she wears these bright, buoyant colors, and even her website looks joyful. It's neon green and tomato red with this big, zingy purple font. So I was surprised, sort of, to learn that her most recent poetry book, which is her sixth, is called The Shining and delves into her passion for horror. I hope to see more horror everywhere, she wrote in an essay about her love for the genre. I hope that the future of art will be drenched in red. The Shining, her version, is a sort of a feminist reimagining of the Stephen King novel and subsequently the Stanley Kubrick film. And for Lasky, the collection came from a feeling of attraction to those artworks and to all the ways that writing toward them allowed her new ways of thinking about how language can be haunted, how the female body can be a site of both horror and humor. In this conversation, Dottie and I talk about how being playful or buoyant is not incompatible with being curious about horror or curious about the things that horrify us. She suggests that maybe admitting the horror of the world or the horror of your circumstances is the necessary precondition to meaningful humor or meaningful change or meaningful connection with other people. As always, you can find us online and check out our digital publication arm of this project at thisisthresholds.com. Thanks for supporting the show. Here's Dorothea Lasky.
I kind of had turned away from poetry, and I was trying to write prose. I was trying to write an essay book and a horror novel. And I was like, poems, get away from me. And then they just kept, you know, knocking on the door and eventually came in the shape of kind of my favorite Shining characters and kind of, you know, let me connect back to them again. And so that felt kind of like a threshold moment because it was almost like poetry was, you know, letting me know it would always be like a friend to me, no matter what I was working on, and that it wasn't going to just like go away that easily. And that it, you know, was kind of, it felt like this book, and it still feels that way, is kind of ushering in what I hope is like a new chapter in my writing.
Maybe can I bring us to the period where you were feeling like, get away from me, poetry? Like, what, yes, why were you, yeah, what had brought you to a phase after so many years?
I've always had a relationship to poetry that, you know, has been more or less not always friendly, because it's just been something that has been a part of me for so, so long. And even, you know, when I was like around 7 is when I first started writing poems. I didn't really know they were poems. So kind of like even before I could conceive what a poem even was, they, you know, poetry kind of entered my life and, you know, deemed itself like important or whatever. And so it's always been kind of a push-pull, and a little bit of antagonism to it, where I'm just, you know, like always kind of like, I'd like to do something else. And I always sort of felt like I wanted to do something of value and that would like help others. And I kind of for a long time felt that poetry was a narcissistic act. And so I just, you know, pushed it away for a long time. And then I kind of realized maybe it wasn't. But yeah, this was kind of one of those moments where I was like wanting to, you know, push myself to do new things. And I didn't want to be, you know, trapped by poetry. And yeah, I think it kind of maybe like, you know, let me know it wasn't trying to trap me, but it was still going to be around.
This reminds me of a line in The Shining from the poem Twins that I wrote down because I felt so seen by it. And the lines are, I exhaust myself on ways to find out how to do the work I'm meant to do.
Yeah, I think it is that feeling. And maybe that's kind of a threshold feeling where you're, you know, working so much to try to figure out what your purpose is as an artist. And yeah, and it's just, you're just going in every direction. And yeah.
What has made you feel over the years like poetry is kind of an antagonist or a narcissistic enterprise? That's an interesting thing to hear from a poet.
Yeah, I think I've come to terms with the idea that maybe it isn't, or at least I want to at this late stage, like feel like it isn't those things. But I think, you know, especially growing up and trying to figure out like what I wanted to do, you know, do with my life, it felt impossible that poems could heal or help people or care for others, which is what I always kind of wanted to do, you know, in my lifetime. And I think I have, you know, kind of figured out or whatever, accepted that poetry can do that. But it also doesn't have to, and it can be actually mean and awful too. So still trying to negotiate that. But yeah, so I think there's that idea of just feeling, you know, that it's not always helpful. You know, art is not always, it can be good and it can heal, but it doesn't always have that burden. So that's kind of sometimes, you know, hard when it channels through you, I guess, when you don't necessarily want to, you know, go there, you know?
Yeah, right. And there, if you are working always with the feeling of obligation that your art is supposed to be doing good in the world, that can be a real, I don't know, it's a real gauntlet to run. Like most of the time, thinking when I sit down to work, like, of course I want to feel like I'm a person in the world who's helping or who's making something that's doing something good. But if any given day, if I'm sitting down thinking, well, this is definitely not saving the world. Maybe I should go, you know, go do something else. But I like the idea of kind of relieving art from always having to do that. That can be one thing it does, but maybe not everything.
Yeah, I think that especially with poetry, because poetry and even the poems that I feel compelled to write are, you know, they they aren't necessarily nurtured. I think of like the poetic voice that I'm engaged with as a kind of trickster, or kind of demon. And so, you know, sometimes that can be friendly, but sometimes like it's not friendly at all. And so, yeah, that I think that's the thing to kind of, you also have to like accept it for what it is as well.
Yeah. I want to go back then to the other thing that you mentioned when we started talking, which was that season where you were living alone and it felt like your poetic voice arrived. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Well, I had always been drawn to poetry that didn't necessarily speak clearly to the reader. I was always interested in kind of coding. Sorry, if I'm not talking clearly. D&T or what? Coding and coding. Like lines with like, you know, just kind of language that might be confusing or mystical or just like imagery that wasn't one for one. And I wasn't necessarily that, you know, interested in talking directly or talking plainly in any way. And it was around that time that I started, you know, thinking about that I really wanted to study like education in a serious way. And so I came to this idea that I really, as much as I could, wanted to write poems that were, you know, like educative in some way, even if the lesson wasn't necessarily like a happy one, and that I wanted to use language that was more direct, you know, and that was more direct than my instinct was to, you know, say it at first or what I found like actually beautiful. And so, but in that kind of realization, it felt like something clicked, you know, and within what I was supposed to be writing and what I was supposed to do.
So what did that translate into on the line level?
Yeah, I think that I had always been really interested in everyday speech and just loving, you know, the way people speak and the way that we talk, not necessarily like that people talk in complete sentences, but there's just, you know, oftentimes in conversation or, you know, just talking on the everyday level, there is like a clarity of syntax and, mm-hmm. And like words are chosen that, you know, can be symbolic, but also they're very direct in what they are describing. And so I think there was a turn in that moment where I decided that there was something like important about making those choices when I could. And I didn't have to do that on every line. I could still say something that, you know, somebody might have a hard time deciphering what this like line means, but that sometimes I would have, you know, the language that could be taking its cues from conversation or everyday speech. Because that is also very beautiful too. In everyday language, the syntax of it is very, very beautiful, like the choices we make.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay, so take me to, you started The Shining in 2020, right?
Yeah, I started it in 2020.
And yes. You were trying to avoid poems. And then what happened?
I know. I was trying to avoid poems, and I was trying to, kind of finish this essay book on memory, which was a shout out to Bernadette Mayer's memory project. Mm-hmm. It's like this.
I know she's a big inspiration for you. I love her too.
Yeah, huge inspiration. And I first learned about her in MFA school from Peter Gizzi, who's a wonderful poet. And when I learned about her, it just was like something that was also maybe a threshold moment for me. And so I was trying to do that and really trying so much. I really, really want to write horror fiction. And so I was like trying, you know, very hard to do that. And I was talking to my editor, Joshua Beckman at Wave Books. And, we're talking about writing poems. And I said, you know, I wasn't that interested in it, even though I had like other books of poems I was working on. And he said, why don't you just write a book, you know, about The Shining? And I was like, well, to write an essay book about The Shining would take me like possibly like my whole life, you know, like I'm not worthy to do that in this moment, to do something like that. and that would take me 40 years. I mean, do I even have that much time left to write that book? Because I assumed he meant, you know, a prose book. He was like, no, you write a poetry book. And as soon as he said that, just the poems came flooding out. It's like it gave me complete license to engage with poetry again. And I think because The Shining has always been this, you know, kind of like set of images in my imagination for so long, it was like poetry's trick to get me to write poems again, because it came in these forms that I really, you know, love, which are forms from The Shining.
Tell me about how you had, like, what you had this long, and it sounds like very reverential, relationship with The Shining as a text and with horror.
Yes. Yeah. I've had such a long relationship with The Shining and with horror. And you're right in using that word reverence, almost like kind of, just the whole like construction of the genre, or just the whole like enterprise of it. I don't know if that's the right word, but is like just something that is very kind of magical to me and just so inspiring to me. And so The Shining in particular has like been a long time obsession for maybe 20 years or more.
And why The Shining over other? I mean, I know that's not the only like piece of horror culture that you, and you also write about Carrie and that, this, that, and the other, but like why The Shining especially?
I think there's something about The Shining that just keeps speaking to me every time I engage with it. And like a poem, I like to think of like a poem as something that you really could read, you know, a million times or every day. And you know, obviously any piece of writing or any piece of art you could say this about, but I think a poem, there's something about it where each new time you engage with it, you kind of see a different facet of it to connect yourself with it. You know, it's always kind of changing and morphing to match, you know, the reader and the reader's mood. And mm-hmm. there's something in The Shining which to me does that. And I think there's particular parts of it that make it so terrifying and real. And just simply one of the things, like in thinking of the time period that it was written and then the time period that the movie was made, it just like very much echoes a kind of like memory of childhood. I mean, not that I stayed in that hotel, which would be interesting, but like, but that just that, yeah, like that, I was born in 78. And so, you know, that's kind of around the time period the book was written. And then the movie, you know, was made in, or the movie was came out in 1980. So just kind of like the idea of Danny being a child and that like helpless feeling, just all those feelings and the imagery, the toys, the fashions, you know, just like feel very, very deep, you know, in my consciousness.
Yeah. You wrote this beautiful essay for Lit Hub about The Shining and about horror. And something that you were talking about is how horror can be something that you wrote so beautifully, I thought. There were two, the one line that I loved, forgive me, I'm going to quote you back to you. As we live in such a hateful, violent world, barreling towards its own destruction, what else has the capacity to speak to us but horror? And later in that piece, you talk about thinking of horror as a genre, as a kind of care, like that there's care encoded in horror as a genre. And I just would love it if, can you tell me a little bit more about that? I wanted to talk to you about that when I read it.
Yeah.
I'm like, how did that enter this project? Because it really does feel like there's like both horror and a lot of sort of care or tender, like sort of twisty tenderness in this collection.
Yeah, I think that life, you know, is so, so, so scary. And, you know, we really don't, sorry, I don't mean to get so deep. We really don't know why we're here, or just the idea of existence is so terrifying. And then so many scary things can happen. And sadly, there is, as we know, you know, I don't know if we want to use like capital E evil, but, you know, humans can do evil things that, there's something I think in horror that like by acknowledging that is actually very nurturing. It's almost like it gives us a platform to test out our fears and test out kind of, you know, our reactions to it, that to me feels like almost maternal in a way, like almost like it's allowing us the space to go there. So we're like prepared in life, or possibly like if, you know, we revisit something that hurt again through, you know, the anxiety of the genre, that allows us kind of a healing thing, you know, becomes like therapeutic. And I'm sure it's not that way for everyone, because if you don't like horror, you shouldn't be subjected to it, of course. But like, yeah, I think for people that are attracted to it, that there is something that's actually almost like sweet about it. And I've always felt that about it, as much as there's so many moments that are scary, that there's just like, there's something that feels, yeah, like there's like a caring gesture to its presence.
I love that idea of thinking about how by making a space to experience and sit with horror, the horror genre is doing something kind of maternal. It's like giving us the safe play zone or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think of, because I've had to go through, I'm not sure if everyone wants to know this, but like I had knee surgery, so I've had to go to like a lot of physical therapy. You know, there's something in like those trials are people testing out like you're, you know, practice carrying this weight, you know, where in that moment you're like, this is really hard, but it's such a maternal act to try to prepare you for when you're going to need to lift the grocery, you know, or whatever, you know, like you're going to need to do these things in real life. So it's like, it's, there's still pain in it, but it's like for the good of trying to help you, you know, in the real situation. And I'm not sure if every horror writer or director has that in mind, but I feel like there is something, just the spirit of the genre feels like it has that in mind, in the way that I've always felt kind of poetry does and does not have that. Like, poetry as a genre feels actually like a little bit of a sharper, meaner kind of spirit than horror to me, for whatever reason. But that may just be my personal, you know.
Wait, say more about that. That is not what I would expect. In some ways, it seems like poetry, I mean, certainly it can be sharp and incisive, but to me, poetry feels often so much about praise, about praising the world or loving the world through looking at it, which maybe also horror does the same. I don't know. I'm just why does poetry feel meaner to you or harsher than horror?
Yeah, and it could just be my own relationship to these voices. You know, it's not, maybe if I was like really deep as like a horror creator, I wouldn't feel that way. And so it's just my relationship to both of those, you know, art forms. But I think there's just something in that incisiveness in poetry that has to be there. There's just a brutality of language in poetry. And I think there's like the decisions can be so sharp and sharp towards the reader when it's really doing its greatest work that is, like ironically, the edges are just feel softer in horror.
So then what happens when those two things collide, like, say, in your collection? How do you think about, are you trying to sand down some of the edges on poetry, or are you sharpening those edges for particular ends? How does that work?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it was kind of a gesture of like kind of making a softer poetry. Because thanks for noticing that there were a lot of poems where I was kind of trying to, you know, inspire the reader or make the reader feel, you know, love or cheer them on, you know, to keep going on something that's difficult, which I think, again, is like maybe what the horror genre does. You know, it's like that maternal instinct, like you can do this kind of vibe is maybe that combination, what I was trying to do with it.
Do you feel like there's a particular poem where that tension between kind of the care instinct and the sharpness or the fear instinct meet particularly for you?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I think like a poem like The Green Maze. I was trying to think about like cheerleading, you know, for people and just like making the reader feel like they can, you know, keep going and that like it's gonna all be okay. And I think that's also just the magic of horror to me that isn't, of course, always the case for every, you know, piece of horror, but, you know, that is like not always present in a poem. Like, I think that's maybe the incisiveness we were talking about. Like a poem doesn't always make you feel like it's going to be, everything's going to be okay. But something about The Shining that I've always loved is there is kind of like this feeling maybe there's a chance that you're going to escape and that things are going to be okay, which isn't very true always to real life, but there's like the beauty of Wendy and Danny like leaving, you know, and that they're able to leave. And so, yeah, I think that like kind of creating poems that were made people feel like they could just keep going because maybe they were going to get to a better place felt important to add to the book. And I feel like The Green Maze maybe does that a little bit.
Would you, if you have it in front of you, would you read it? For me, I have it in front of me too, but I would love to hear it at this point.
Sure. Thank you so much. The Green Maze. All of the artists of the world are my brothers and sisters, even as I am locked in this house of the high ceilings and slanted bookcases with all of the charlatans and naysayers, the soupy packagers and droopy preachers, pushing me down a ditch or through the open window to an indefinable snow hill where I will surely not survive it. I still call in my family to know what's real or not. And whatever they say to you, chasing you down a hallway that will be forever estranged, Be who you are. It is your job to carry it on. No matter what bull is chasing you for 100 years with an axe in the green landscape of your dreams, live your dreams and push through until it is daybreak and you see the sun begging you to find the new space to go on. After all, it was and always will be your job to go free. So protect the things that are worth preserving. That's partially you too. Protect those upturned faces into the sun. No matter what, they must carry on. Mm.
I love that. I really, thank you for that. Thank you for reading it. I really hear not just the shining there, but also echoes of COVID. And it's probably just because I know you were writing these poems during COVID, but especially that feeling of, even as I am locked in this house, of the high ceilings and slanted bookcases, which leads me to a question I had wanted to bring up, which is this I, you know, how you construct the I of this poem and of these poems, and who you imagine that I is addressing, especially with this kind of message of go on, go on, go on.
Yes, I think that the I is such like a tricky thing to think about, especially in poetry, because, you know, we're kind of taught that it's the persona, it's like a mask, it's something constructed. And I still really believe in that. But I think that there's a tendency, especially, you know, with the internet, for people to just like want to conflate the I with like the ultimate voice of the poet, that it's like a nonfiction I kind of, mm-hmm. which I know isn't always the true I either. But you know, it like there's this way that when the I says something, it's like from the self. And I've always loved playing with that, you know, in poetry and just thinking about how multiplicitous and duplicitous that I can be. And again, mm-hmm. you know, having all of those ways that it can always change and be and not be the self, because the self isn't really fixed. And so I think that in this book, there was the challenge of it was that it is kind of like an ekphrastic book, and it is channeling some of these characters that already have, you know, selfness of their own. And so like, how does the I interject? But I think that still in this book, like I would hope like in all, you know, my books, the I is like a kind of persona construction that is, like Dickinson would say, like representative of the verse, like a representative of it, and has, you know, some elements of like a self, but isn't, its name is my name, but is not me, I guess.
Yeah, I thought of this I as sort of hovering or almost spectral, like somewhere between the poet and the shining, right? That it's and that it's sort of between, and it's also inhabiting all the voices of the shining, and also the, you know, the voice of the poet, or the poet sort of persona all at once. I loved something I really loved about this collection is this feeling of like, who is the speaker, and like the feeling that the answer to that changes even within poems sometimes.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. And I, you know, because I think that's definitely what I would hope it would feel like. So thank you for feeling that way. I mean, not that always should be, you know, but I mean, I'm glad. Yeah. And but I think, you know, it's interesting because I think my favorite scene in The Shining is in the movie is that wonderful opening scene where you're sailing through, you know, the mountains, and you're kind of sailing and you're watching the car, and you have this like, just, you know, bird's eye view of everything. And I love the mystery of like what that actually is, looking down and knowing that they're traveling there and kind of surveilling and kind of watching. And then, you know, it's like immediately in the car with them. And I had a poem in an like earlier drafts of the book that was like, of that, you know, it's called opening scene and it's kind of like of that moment. And it was taken out, you know, of the book. But I like to think the persona is kind of whatever that entity is, where, you know, it kind of got figured out that this was going to be the shining party of this book. And so it kind of, you know, started sailing through the sky and then entered the space with the people.
Yeah, that reminds me, is it the final poem? It's the final poem of the collection, is going through a mountain. Is that image?
Yeah, yes, yeah. And so like, it, you know, it used to be that this poem opening scene was the beginning, but it's like kind of haunting the rest of the book. And yeah, that just that idea of that kind of omniscient or like kind of witchy, you know, presence that has the ability to go through a mountain, which would be impossible, you know, as like a person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you feel like? I mean, when we started talking, you were describing this phase of your writing life when you really wanted to leave poetry behind and you were trying to write horror fiction. And then you wound up really kind of leaning into horror using poetry. And it felt like a homecoming to you in some way with poetry. What were you able to do with horror in poems that felt distinct from what you had been working on in fiction and in prose?
Yeah, I think because I was trying so hard to learn new skills, that, you know, kind of coming back to poetry was like this embrace, you know, like you don't have to leave us, you know what you're doing and we know you, and just come home to this kind of like safe, not safe space, but a space where you know you're welcome and you know the contours of everything around you, you know, better. But I still have hopes to write horror fiction. I'm just it's my kind of idea that this book is sort of like an entryway into that, and into like practicing what that mode would be like.
Yeah. Do you feel any differently about horror after having written this book than you did before? Or is there such, like, has your, even your kind of formal thinking about it changed?
Yeah, I think that I feel not as distant from it. So still reverent to it, but kind of closer to it than ever before, just by like having that creator, you know, connection to it, has made me feel, you know, more intimate, and that it's not something that I'm watching necessarily or reading as like a spectator, but that I'm possibly like entering the kind of realm of, you know, this imagery and like things that happen in the genre. And that's actually really scary, to be honest.
Wait, tell me more.
Well, just that, I think, you know, that kind of like, as like a writer, you know, you have to actually go there into places and kind of like own it as you would with a poem. And that can be a little scary, because it's, you know, just the imagery can be sort of awful to like engage in, you know, when you're actually writing it or actually doing it.
Yeah. Can you give me an example from inside this book?
Well, the poem Blue Christmas, I've always loved the twins. You know, from The Shining, you know, I wanted to connect with them. But, you know, there's always a part, especially in the film, when I see that, where I do like look away. You know, I don't necessarily like, that's not the part of the scene that I love to look at. I love the sublime image of them standing there and looking creepy and saying what, you know, the poem of forever and ever and ever. I love that line. And so there's a way in writing that poem where I couldn't, you know, I had to like engage with the actual imagery, and that felt very scary, you know, to do, like actually do. And that line always kind of, there's a line in there that is very violent, that kind of always gives me a jolt and makes me a little scared myself.
Which one is it?
It's like the one. Okay, I'm gonna go to the poem.
Right. Okay. I have it right in front of us, and it's funny because I have it right in front of me, and I have candidates for what I think. This poem stood out to me as scary.
Yeah. Well, it's the line, the blue will be muted soon after they will show us chopped up. And I think honestly, the blue being muted is something that's like, that definitely scares me. But I think in a lot of poems, maybe I would have stopped there, because when I think of like a muted blue, I immediately think of like images of heaven or something funereal or something like a coffin satin in like that kind of, you know, sickly blue that is very disturbing, that sometimes is like present in like a funereal situation. And I would kind of stop there, and that would be like evocative enough in my mind. But I think the chopped up was, you know, obviously very direct, and it's a violent line, you know, in and of itself.
Right.
Yeah.
The idea of, you know, years later, they will film us as children wearing matching dresses again, but the blue will be muted soon after they will show us chopped up. Yeah. It's, and even just ending that stanza on chopped up feels so, such a jolt, so abrupt, so frightening.
Yes. And I always think of a line break and a stanza break as kind of, you know, like that position of like whatever word you put there is being very violent, because, you know, you really are kind of chopping up the thought or chopping up the image. So it's like just a triple kind of whammy, you know, to have the chopped up as being like the end of that line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think maybe the fourth stanza was a little bit trying to let out the tension that it feels like when I read that line, or having, you know, written it.
Like a lingering question I have is how counterintuitive it feels to me to think about creating a space of horror as a gesture of care. But I also think that my understanding of that has changed a lot in, funnily enough, the years since you started writing these poems, right? That because the world is horrifying, often making a space where we can really feel that safely is really a gesture of huge generosity. And I know you were sort of framing it as maternal care as well. And I guess I'm curious how you think of that as part of your job going forward, just like as a person and as a poet who doesn't always believe that poems are doing good things in the world. But that's a very powerful, noble thing you're describing a poem being able to do.
Yeah. I think about like the lessons, you know, that might be present in a poem or might be present, you know, in any piece of art. But I know I was thinking of this interview with Jordan Peele, where he was asked, you know, what's the connection between horror and comedy, because he's so, you know, wonderful in both of those genres, of course. Like, he's a genius in both. And it was like something to the effect of like, both have the twist. You know, both kind of do unexpected things that you couldn't have predicted. And that, like, that's kind of, you know, beauty when you're experiencing it. But I think about poetry that way, that like often a poem, you know, has the twist or has like the turn, or, you know, maybe all three of those things have like many turns that happen where things unexpected happen. And I think that in a way, that twist or that turn might have to do with care, you know, showing the reader, the viewer, or the person that's experiencing the art, that these twists can happen, that they can be completely unexpected. And sometimes, of course, they can be wonderful, but sometimes they can be horrifying. Just like in a communal space, like letting people experience that together, I would hope is a way to make them feel less alone in the world, you know, because it's showing them that these turns happen, you know, everywhere and everything. And that, you know, that it's good to experience that in art.
Thresholds is produced by Jordan Kistner and Drew Broussard. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshavood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Lorelei Grossman. Sign up for our newsletter, listen to past episodes, and get in touch at our website, thisisthresholds.com. Don't forget to rate and review our show at Apple Podcasts. It really helps. Thanks. We'll see you soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.